Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
Whatever you think of Joe Rogan, it seems clear he's the figurehead for an interesting, maybe significant movement in American intellectual and political life. And whether you listen to his podcast or not, you probably know who he is and have at least some sense of where he's coming from. You're probably thinking of someone obsessed with MMA fighters and stand-up comedians, someone who's politically liberal but skeptical of COVID restrictions and gender identity discourse. And you're right. In a recent piece for The Atlantic, the journalist Helen Lewis describes Rogan's appeal for the millions who listen as an untamable curiosity that makes him open to plainly marginal ideas. Lewis wanted to ask Rogan about the ideology of this counterculture he's exporting from Austin, Texas, but she knew her chances of getting an interview. As she put it in her piece, no human in history has needed publicity less than Joe Rogan.
One of the challenges of doing journalism at a time when everybody's got their own microphone is access. And I was pretty sure from the start that I wouldn't get a chance to interview Joe Rogan. So I thought, how am I going to see him in person? And he runs a club called the Comedy Mothership in Austin. And he's there 3 nights a week. You know, he doesn't need to be. He earns enough money. It's chicken feed to him. But he just genuinely seems to love being on stage. And the one thing, you know, if you're going to a comedy club, I would always advise is never, ever, ever sit in the front row, because you will become the entertainment. But I, of course, was terrified that I wouldn't get in. So I was there super early. And so they sat me pretty much on the stage in the front row at a table with another guy who turned out to be an Australian stand-up comedian called Nathan. And I was just right there, Rogan, you know, 2 feet away from me. I was watching him do his set, you know, which is an extraordinary experience, really, and one that, you know, millions of American men would have, you know, killed to swap places with me, watching Joe Rogan make obscene hand gestures very, very close to their eyeballs. And, you know, the brilliant thing about the audience is they know what's funny, right? The audience acts as your editor when you're putting a stand-up comedy routine together. And so Joe Rogan, who could be living this very rarefied life, you know, behind his gates and his lovely home on Lake Austin, actually does at least get some, you know, feedback from people all the time. I would say that's quite limited feedback, because everybody there was a Joe Rogan fan, right? This was not a tough crowd by any means. But nonetheless, when you're doing stand-up, you know, when people groan, or worse, when they don't react at all, that's the bit that tells you you've got it wrong. The other stuff I thought is that, you know, I always think of myself as being on the left, but when I see comedians acting like it's super edgy to say that men and women are different, I think something weird happened on the left for that kind of humour, you know, that very men are from Mars, women are from Venus humour, to now have been reborn as not hack stuff, but as newly fresh and kind of underground and exciting. Like, oh, did you know that, like, women sometimes discuss with their girlfriends their relationship problems? Shocking stuff.
What were you hoping to learn by just going to see a set, you know?
I wanted to see Joe Rogan in his natural environment. You know, the one thing you want when you're doing an interview is to see somebody in their element, you know, see what makes them comfortable, see how they act around other people. And that's what I wanted to see from Joe Rogan. You know, he's an extremely rich man. You know, he moved out of California to Austin in the hope of finding something a bit more heterodox. But does he actually ever now really encounter people who disagree with him? Does he live entirely surrounded by fans and sycophants and people who want to be on the Joe Rogan Experience because it's a massive podcast? And, you know, what has that done to him? Is he still humble? Is he still self-deprecating and self-aware? And that was the stuff that I hoped to find out. I also was interested if there was a difference between his public persona, you know, this is a man who talks for hours every week on his podcast, and what he was doing privately, you know, the kind of material he was just doing in front of a club audience. Because that's often the challenge that's thrown at people who are either heterodox or right-wing, right, that there is a mask, and the mask sometimes slips. And they're not just flirting with these edgy ideas, they're fully paid-up racists or homophobes or whatever it might be. And actually, there is, with Joe Rogan, not a great deal of distance between what he says in the club and what he says on the podcast. So, you know, you can calibrate how you feel about him from his public statements pretty well, I think.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Helen Lewis is with us for the hour. Her story for The Atlantic is in part a profile of the Roganverse, or as she puts it, that intellectual firmament of manosphere influencers. Lewis questions whether Rogan and his followers are really all that heterodox, whether their grievances and routines are a little played out by now. She also wonders if this coalition might be fracturing in the future, but for now, it makes sense to take it seriously because, she says, Joe Rogan may be the single most influential person in the United States.
I think the two issues that he has ended up being most attacked over are COVID, on which he, you know, has been quite skeptical both of restrictions and quite open-minded about its origins, and has interviewed people who are, frankly, pseudoscientists. And then there's the transgender issue, which I've also written about a lot, in which he was one of the very early people who said, actually, you know, male bodies and female bodies are different in ways that matter, for example, in professional sports. Now, he's a mixed martial arts commentator, so I think that's where he came from on that. So I think there will be people on the left who don't listen to him who think he's, you know, just a standard issue kind of reactionary rich white guy living in Texas. And I don't think that is entirely fair. I think he's definitely gravitated towards the right. You know, people in his orbit certainly have. And then I think the other trope about him is that he's a conspiracy theorist. Mm. And that's something that he embraces and actually kind of owns and plays with himself. You know, during the set Burn the Boats, which is based on the stuff that I saw in Austin, he talks about the fact that, you know, since COVID, and he feels that the media lied to him about that, he doesn't even really believe that we landed on the moon. Mm. You know, he's always been interested in aliens. He's always been interested in ancient civilizations and, you know, who really built the pyramids and, you know, what all that kind of stuff. You know, can the US government control the weather? And I think in the 90s, I grew up watching The X-Files, that stuff all seemed quite harmless. And I think people don't find it harmless anymore, right? They find it symptomatic of a really poisonous distrust in authority that goes beyond healthy skepticism and goes into something perhaps more knee-jerk.
Andrew Yang, you mentioned, called him the male Oprah, Joe Rogan. How influential is he in the scheme
of things? Incredibly,
yeah.
Incredibly influential. I mean, I think his crown has slipped slightly recently. You know, he occasionally gets knocked off the top spot in the Spotify charts by Tucker Carlson, who since leaving Fox has built himself into a really big alternative media brand. But, you know, he's consistently been the most listened to podcaster in America now for several years. He is, you know, he's worth hundreds of millions of dollars to Spotify. And, you know, you can look at the sales graphs of books. I interviewed a couple of academics, this didn't make it into the piece, about this kind of sales spikes that people see after they've been on Rogan. And, you know, one of them pointed out to me that there are large numbers of American men, 18 to 24, who report that they haven't read a single book in the previous year. And there are another group of those young men whose only book that they've read is one that they've heard about on Joe Rogan. So it might be David Goggins's memoir. You know, it might be, you know, one of these books by one of these former Navy SEALs. You know, it might be Jordan Peterson's book. You know, these are sort of male-inflected self-help and biography. And without Joe Rogan, they wouldn't be reading those books. They wouldn't be reading any books.
Well, it also brings up the thing you mentioned in the piece is it's a giant talk show circuit. You get on Rogan and you are often running for books and other appearances. And it made me wonder, you know, how much is one appearance on Joe Rogan, who has like what averages 11 million listeners per podcast episode? Like, what would that translate in terms of book sales or just getting followers?
Yeah, I mean, I think he to some extent made Jordan Peterson happen.
Yeah.
That's the Canadian psychologist turned I guess, culture warrior now, but has had several very successful books. And at one point, you know, the New York Times was describing Jordan Peterson as the most important public intellectual working today. And because the subjects that Peterson was interested in, you know, the kind of idea of responsibility and young men's place in the world, and as more and more the years have gone on, the kind of his belief in that equality is a sort of poisonous doctrine. Mm-hmm. Those were kind of themes that I think really spoke to the Rogan audience. He's not a star maker in the sense he can't just have someone on and make them happen. They have to already, you know, mesh quite well with his audience. I know people who have been on and have been waiting for the kind of mega bucks to roll in, and then it hasn't really happened because they weren't right for the audience. But, you know, Andrew Yang is really interesting. So he ran as a presidential candidate, and he was talking on the Rogan show about universal basic income, mm-hmm. which is this very popular but controversial left-wing idea that instead of having benefits, you know, you just pay people a flat rate. And that is an idea that's been knocking around the fringes of American public policy for a long time. But you know what? That's the kind of idea that Joe Rogan likes. And he doesn't have very many leftists on these days, but he's had, you know, Cornel West on. You know, he would have, you know, he's had Bernie Sanders on. He said Bernie Sanders was the most appealing candidate to him in a previous election cycle. So, yeah, he is open just plainly marginal ideas. And in America at the moment, more of them are generated by that kind of right-wing intellectual circuit than the left one.
You describe sort of the essence of the Joe Rogan brand. You kind of give the characteristics, body around his fans. He's respectful of his wife. He's loyal to his friends. He's indulgent with his dog. He's one of the characteristics is he's very self-deprecating in terms of his sense of humor. And it's interesting you say you wonder if that's going to stay that way. But what does all this add up to, do you figure? He does seem quite self-aware. He does seem quite humble, don't you think?
By comparison to lots of the people in the orbit, you know, in 2018, then New York Times journalist Barry Weiss described him as being part of this circuit she called the intellectual dark web.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's got a spectrum of people ranging from Ben Shapiro, who is a straightforward, you know, conservative, through to people who saw themselves as being much more heterodox. Mm. And Rogan was at the heterodox end of that. And, you know, he, as I say, has moved much more towards the right, as that whole sphere has done. I mean, his favourite politicians for a long time have been Tulsi Gabbard and Robert F. Kennedy Jr., you know, who both sort of started off as kind of mavericks and have now ended up on the, you know, Donald Trump's transition team. So that whole sphere that he's surrounded by has kind of gravitated towards MAGA and towards the right. But Rogan isn't fully there yet. He wrote in a candidate last time. Mm-hmm. You know, his parents, he said, you know, still vote Democrat. And that's interesting to me. You know, and there was an interesting recent episode where he had a couple of comedian friends on, and they were, you know, they were all ragging on Jordan Peterson, and he was quite loyally defending him as his friend. But these other guys were going, well, you know, the guy's just gone crazy now. Mm-hmm. And he does actually, to that extent, hear those contrary opinions from people that he respects, right? Whereas I think lots of people on that talk show circuit have an instant dismissal of anybody who disagrees with them or criticises them as, well, you would say that, you know, you're part of the left-wing media blob, you're part of the MSM, you know. They have a kind of complete defensive shield against any kind of criticism by dismissing it because of the basis of people making those criticisms. I think the stand-up comedy circuit is, it's a brutally status-obsessed place, right? Because you can see who's getting the biggest audiences, who's getting the biggest laughs. But it's also one where there's a certain premium placed on being able to, you know, take it as well as dishing it out. And I think that, you know, if we're going to make the argument that Joe Rogan has stayed a bit more sane than some of the other people in the intellectual dark web, I think that the comedy scene has really got a lot to do with that.
Huh. His politics are hard to pin down. I think some people anyway are trying to sort of work it out, get thrown off by his quite liberal perspective, supports gay marriage, as you say, in the piece, and gay rights. He supports abortion rights. Is it libertarianism, do you think? I mean, have you sort of worked it out?
I think libertarianism is a good way to describe it. So, you know, the idea that you can't, don't tell me what to do, you know, don't tread on me. Somebody described it as being right-wing hippie, which I think is another way of doing it, right? Because lots of the politics are interesting. And I think his resistance to the COVID vaccinations, for example, comes out of what we would call a kind of crunchy aesthetic. You know, the idea that American food is full of weird additives that you wouldn't be allowed in Europe. And, you know, medical companies are trying to sell you drugs to problems that they've convinced you that they have. You know, these are all things that I think are very appealing to large swathes of people. You know, the idea that environmental protections are really not very strong in the US. And I think that part of his background really can't be overlooked. You know, he's always doing Instagram videos from his, like, cold plunge pool that he's got in his back garden. And I think, you know, there's something that is incredibly piquant to me. He, you know, he's also on testosterone replacement therapy, which he says is for, you know, unnaturally low levels of testosterone. So are quite a lot of people in that orbit. You know, I think if you look at Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and his ability to bench press in his 70s, you know, and these are not illegal things to be on by any means, but there is a really interesting feeling that people who are very worried about vaccines are quite willing to put a lot of other stuff in their bodies that maybe has actually less scientific backup. But that's what I mean. That's the kind of hippiness, right? That's the crunchiness.
Hmm. Well, you write about how part of his charm and appeal is how he has this, as you put it, this untamable curiosity, and how he approaches the people and the subjects on his podcast with this kind of stoner wonderment, is how you put it. And I wanted to ask you a little bit more about that, because sprinkled in with these serious subjects, as you say, talking about, you know, conservation and food additives and stuff like that, are these conspiracy tidbits. I mean, one of the things you mentioned is he wondered in one podcast, and maybe said this in more, but wondered if President Biden was replaced by a body double for the State of the Union. And he, like a long conversation about that. He seemed convinced of it in some ways. Not so long ago, he also talked about how he thought Kamala Harris had these earrings that were you know, earphone. Have you heard this? The devices that she used to cheat during the debate. So he throws this stuff out too. Like, where does all that fit in the larger conversation?
I think there's a level of, I'm going to say gullibility. Yes, I think that is true. That you also see in Elon Musk, right, who spends a lot of time browsing his own service, X, formerly Twitter, and just sort of sees interesting things and sort of assumes that they're true and doesn't have a really great filter for plausibility. And both of those are really good examples, actually. So the earrings went through a great parabola of they're fake earrings that are actually earpieces that are feeding her lines to, no, they're not. Here are the specific earrings. I think we've seen them on the, you know, Tiffany website. To then people like Brett Weinstein, another member of the intellectual dark web, saying, oh, that rumor that they were earpieces was put around so that we'd fall for it and it would discredit us, which is a kind of slightly mind-bending way of justifying your own your own lack of media literacy. And then the same thing happened with the State of the Union, where his guest had to tell him, the State of the Union is live and there are Republicans who come and watch the State of the Union. And if you think they've replaced Biden with a body double, either those Republicans haven't noticed when they're sitting there, you know, 6 feet away from him, or are they in on it too? Mm-hmm. And I think those two are really symbolic of just, the line is, you know, that I think about is, it's good to have an open mind, but not so much that your brain falls out.
Right.
And there's a more elegant way of saying this that the social scientists talk about, which is when you hear hoofbeats, think horses, not zebras. Right. Yeah. Sometimes there is a kind of amazing explanation for something. Sometimes something is a cover up and a conspiracy. But 99% of the time, the dominant narrative is, you know, is broadly the right one. And I think that's why it's interesting that, you know, he gravitated to the gender issue, because I think, and that was one that, in my view, and I know not everybody agrees with this, that liberals really did get wrong. They really overreached in saying that actually biological sex didn't really matter, and then there's no way of proving that male athletes are faster than female ones, and did so in a way that I think meant that people who were following the science on this felt kind of weirded out and excluded. You know, you had this group of people who was saying all the time, trust the science, and actually all of the science that we have says that, you know, male bodies are on average stronger, better grip strength, better VO2 max, you know, all of these reasons that, you know, are why every single record is held by a male athlete in pretty much every discipline that there is. And so I think it's always a challenge when you're someone like me or someone like Rogan who writes about, you know, controversies that you remember to calibrate your kind of compass to the correct level of skepticism. Not too little skepticism, but not too much and become overly skeptical of everything.
Helen Lewis, she's a staff writer for The Atlantic. Her article is called How Joe Rogan Remade Austin. We'll put a link to it on our website, radiowest.org. Take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, Helen Lewis of The Atlantic is with us to explain the Joe Rogan brand. Rogan's podcast is wildly successful. He invites legit scientists as well as crackpots on his show, and he hears them out with what Lewis describes as the same stoner wonderment. Rogan has made the institutional left the common enemy for disaffected liberals and conservatives. So we're talking about his appeal and what it could mean for the election and for Austin, Texas. You know, I think it's telling to see how Joe Rogan is processing information in real time. Like when you listen to his podcast, there's this live fact-checking, I guess I should put that in quotes, sort of operation that goes on in the show. It's his – and maybe you should say something about his fact-checker. Rogan fans will know the name Jamie.
But yeah, pull that up, Jamie. Because he is the one tasked when somebody's on some great tear about mRNA vaccines with being the one who has to sort it out. And, you know, the thing is – I work for The Atlantic, and when I write a piece for The Atlantic, it goes through a editing and fact-checking process. For the magazine, that is an incredibly in-depth. My everyone will go through my recordings, will check back with interviewees about times and dates, and it is astonishing to me how easy it is to be to misremember something, right, or to be sloppy about something without even realizing that your brain has smudged that detail and got it wrong. And in written form, you can go through and just check at that level. And one of the problems, I think, with us moving back to an oral and a visual culture, you know, the way that print is declining, but people are really getting more of their news and entertainment from TikTok, Instagram, whatever it might be, or podcasts, is that it's really not amenable to that kind of, you know, dry, nerdy fact-checking process. Fundamentally, we tend to believe in the people who are most charismatic or the people who are telling the most appealing story or narrative. And it's very hard for facts to really intrude on that in real time when you're listening to somebody who's very funny, very charming, and very convinced of what they're saying. And that's just an inherent problem with the medium. So, you know, while I appreciate the gesture of having Jamie there, there is only so much that kind of one man can do. And no one can be an expert on everything. That's the other thing about the range of subjects on that Rogan podcast is extraordinary. Yeah. As you say, from theoretical physics through to ancient civilizations through to, you know, through to politics, through to the Middle East and more.
Well, and often that fact check that's done live is just basically a quick Google search.
Google. Yeah, yeah. It's a bit Google. And now, you know, that will now, from now on, go and be probably AI-based, right? That will be whatever the AI answer from Google is, which, you know, it reflects the best of the internet, but sometimes will probably be a hallucination.
Right.
Yeah, it's really hard. But, you know, how on earth, if somebody says to you, actually, X number of people died because of this vaccine, that is the answering that question and whether or not there are compounding factors and, you know, anything else and what, like, how good the studies are and all that sort of stuff is something that would take you a couple of hours just to fully comb through. The idea that you can just deliver an instant judgment on it is just extremely hopeful indeed.
What you describe the Roganite philosophy in the piece this way. You say people must tolerate wacko ideas in order to hear intriguingly heretical ones. How do you understand that give and take? Because when you can only rely on so much actual fact, I guess, when you're listening to a podcast like that. And you can be intrigued by the idea of ancient civilizations building the pyramids. But like then what are the limits of that? What are the costs of that to actual information that's getting out into the, you know, into the world?
I think it's really difficult because, again, it's about calibrating the correct level of tolerance. And the pandemic is a really good example of that. You know, I was based in Britain during that, but writing for an American publication. And it was very interesting to me to see that what was the common sense consensus in Britain and Europe was, you know, not shared in large swathes of America in both directions. And one example of that would be the fact that Britain took a policy decision that it wanted schools to be the last thing that closed and the first thing that opened. And you get a situation in America where in some red states people were, you know, never fully locked down at all, really, versus in some blue states you had school closures that went over into the, you know, fall and even longer than that, with really severe consequences for learning loss. And you know, I talked to people in Austin, including a woman who had moved there from California, because she felt that her kids were being really negatively affected because they weren't going to school. Yeah. And that's talking about a population that were absolutely minimal risk of having severe complications from COVID. You know, the problem was that they would spread it amongst themselves and then bring it home, and that might go on and affect adults. But, you know, the cost-benefit analysis there was different in Britain than it was in some parts of California and elsewhere in America. The same thing with masking. You know, the advice on masking did change, and it was accompanied by this idea that, you know, why don't you just listen to the scientists? If you're not listening to the scientists, you must be some kind of kook. But actually, that's not actually how science works. Science doesn't proceed by one person in authority telling you something, right? It proceeds by people doing experiments and collecting data, and then you evaluating that data. And what eventually came out of that was the way that people used masks in the real world, where they were using a bit of sock or not wearing it properly or taking it down to sneeze. They were not as effective as the initial studies suggested and hoped that they were. And so masking policies became a kind of theatre of saying that we're taking this seriously, of people showing that they were taking it seriously, rather than being as effective against transmission as was initially hoped. You know, the same thing with the way that the vaccines, excellent protection against dying, but not as good protection against transmission as people initially hoped. And so I think that's why the pandemic is definitely part of this story, because it was a story in which, you know, updated information was very hard to assimilate into the American political process. And people ended up making decisions based on their prior political beliefs, whether that was, as you say, a kind of libertarianism and belief that the government shouldn't be able to do these things to you, or it was a progressivism that thought, you know, you needed to be slightly more authoritarian for people's own good. And I think it really highlighted that big ideological cleavage right down the middle of American life.
Well, then Joe Rogan, he on one hand hosts vaccine denialists on his show. He promotes ivermectin, you know, that deworming drug as a treatment for COVID. But then on the other hand, as you say, he also gave voice to those who felt that some of these policies, as you mentioned, like outdoor masking, were just not supported by evidence. So like how much is he – I mean that's quite a mixed bag.
Yeah, you know? That's one way of describing it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's really, really difficult. And I think that was the kind of decisions that every news organization was making during COVID. But here's the thing that I realize I find it more and more annoying, the division between what's called kind of legacy media and alternative media. Hmm. And alternative media is now incredibly profitable and powerful. And we should stop treating it like it's just a couple of guys in a shed who, you know, and it's not fair to pick on them because they don't have the resources of the New York Times or NPR or The Atlantic. Yeah. Actually, Joe Rogan is making millions. And if he chooses to spend those millions on a nice backyard pool rather than on an army of fact checkers and editors, then that is a decision that he has made, right? When I write something, it goes through a lot of editorial layers. I'm sure the same thing happens to you because we really do care about getting everything right. And we might want to have, you know, five or six people in a room hashing out what they think about something and where the kind of line is to be drawn. The alternative media has kind of cut all that out and reduced some of this stuff down to just here's an authority head and you should listen to me. And that is their own choice, and they need to be held accountable for that choice. There is no reason that we should kind of grade Joe Rogan on a curve. He should be held to the same standards, I think, really, as, you know, as a, at least a local paper. You know, he's a budget several times bigger than any local newspaper in America. So why is he, you know, why, you know, these are perfectly legitimate questions for him to face.
Well, you hear this from his, I think, friend, Sam Harris, who's quite conflicted about Joe Rogan. I think he likes him a lot. He's been on his podcast a number of times. But one of the things he said recently, I wrote this down, when you give a platform to people who are spreading lies or misinformation, you're not just engaging in dialogue. You're contributing to a larger problem.
Yeah, and I also think we have to be pretty real about the incentives involved here, which is that there are people who are just flat out nuts, I'm going to say it, and they still continue to get booked on that kind of talk show circuit. I'm not talking so much Rogan, even as the many mini Rogans and Rogan imitators, right? And what do you actually have to do to be considered, you know, an outcast by those people? Well, it's quite tough because actually when people are outcasts, other people still want to interview them in a kind of, oh, you know, you're not allowed to hear what this person's saying. You know, an example I'm thinking of recently is Candace Owens, who started off as a very popular cultural commentator and has recently taken a pretty wild swerve into flat-out anti-Semitism. And therefore, Ben Shapiro of The Daily Wire, who is himself Jewish, said, you know, this is just, she needs to be kind of cast out of this movement. But then I see her not 2 weeks ago being interviewed on a quote-unquote heterodox podcast by an Australian broadcaster who left Australia's state broadcaster because, frankly, people are going to watch that.
Yeah,
she's going to say wild things. You know, and I think that's the problem, the kind of arc of podcasting bends towards people who are going to say outrageous things. It's very comparable to the way that watching a Trump rally is often more entertaining, quote unquote, than watching a Senate debate hearing, right?
Yeah.
Just because he's going to start talking about sharks and Hannibal Lecter, and it's weird and wild and whatever it might be, and I think that is a huge bias in both audiences and therefore journalists towards outrage, incendiariness, excitement, you know, taboo breaking, and we haven't really kind of worked out how to manage that. It's very unfashionable to say maybe some things would be very popular, but you shouldn't do them anyway. You know, and that's not really the kind of, what's the level of responsibility that the people in that alternative podcasting scene feel about guarding the level of discourse? I don't think they do. I think they think let a thousand flowers bloom and the best ideas will always win out. And I wish I were that optimistic.
Well, we should talk about what the effect of all of this on the city of Austin, because part of the piece is about Austin and what seems to be like this significant, I think, transformation of this. Is that overstating it? I mean, it seems like this movement, the sort of Roganite universe, has one of the journalists, for example, you talked to mentioned that it really does feel like the arrival of Rogan changed the whole town. Do you think that's right?
I think it can depend on where you are. You know, I had lots of great feedback on this feature saying, this is really interesting. Yes, you're right. Austin isn't the same as it used to be. And I had another equally valid set of feedback, which was, I live in Austin. I haven't noticed any of this. You know, I just take my dog to the park.
Right.
And Joe Rogan does not impinge upon my life at all. Yeah. And I think that's very true. I think the reason I wanted to write it is that I think America has this brilliant sense of place as mythology, right? Mm. If I say to you, Florida man, you know what I'm talking about, right? I'm talking about somebody wearing flip-flops, like wrestling an alligator and and all of those kind of things. Or if I say, you know, New Englander, buttoned-up New Englander, right? You know what I'm talking about. If I say Portland, you know what kind of person I'm referring to. And not everybody in Florida or Portland or Massachusetts conforms to those stereotypes. But enough people do that they attract more people who are like that, right? Because they feel that they would vibe with those people. And what has happened in Austin is that Rogan and a variety of other people have created a very distinct vibe that has attracted people, particularly from California, particularly refugees from Silicon Valley, you know, tech guys. So the other person who only briefly gets a name check in this that I think is really important is a guy called Joe Lonsdale, who co-founded Palantir. With Peter Thiel. Now, Peter Thiel's great protege is J.D. Vance, right? So this is a firm that has a great influence on American politics. And Joe Lonsdale has been a big funder of UATX, which is the new university in Austin, which is specifically designed to not be left-leaning, as the majority of, you know, college professors in the U.S. are. So he's part of a distinct effort to turn this into a heterodox city,
a more conservative city. And one of the ways he wants to do that is by educating young people in a different way. You know, that's not a... I'm not mischaracterizing him. You know, that is explicitly his, yeah. his stated aims for what he wants to do. And so I think there is an attempt to take Austin, which has traditionally been an incredibly blue city in a red state, and say, actually, this can be a place that's got all of the amenities of California, but without what we see as the kind of chiding, nanny-ish progressivism of California, and without California's taxes, and without California's restrictions on what you can build where. Right, which is also a big part of the libertarian issue, the puzzle. You know, if you're Elon Musk and you want to build, you know, your gigafactory, you want to build Snailbrook, your new community, Texas says, you know, and how big would you like it? right. Whereas California says, I'm going to need you to fill out some forms. and so I think that's, you know, that's where Austin kind of now sits in a particular pantheon of, an American mythological canon.
Well, you went to this new University of Austin. He went down there, talked to the provost there, who said he wanted to get politics out of the classroom, said that faculty members will have succeeded if the students can't guess how they vote from what they say in class. And I think that might be appealing to a lot of people. What did you find out about the school itself? I mean, it sort of aspires to have this kind of neutral position, but it also it seems to have a lot of supporters who are kind of on the right or certainly conservative.
Yeah, I mean, I characterized it as anti-woke.
Yeah.
And I know that's a very contested phrase, but essentially a reaction against the idea of a certain kind of left-wing authoritarianism, right? The idea that the left were in culturally ascendant and they got to tell everybody else how to live their lives. Mm. And those anti-woke sphere, you know, encompasses both people I would think of as liberals and people I would think of as conservatives. And at the moment, in the last couple of years, they've been kind of joined together in their shared annoyance at progressives. But they actually may end up fracturing, and I think already are kind of fracturing. But you're right. I think there are lots of people in America who think, well, why can't there be some conservative universities too? Mm. Why is that a kind of illegitimate thing? Why should I have to go and sit around people who, you know, who don't share my politics, but also I feel despise me for them? I read Ron DeSantis, the governor of Florida's memoir, and he talks about, I can't remember if he went to Harvard or Yale, but anyway, he talks about turning up at the Ivy League. Mm. He claims in his jean shorts, but you know, sitting in very Floridian, but you know, sort of surrounded by these people who just not only were much more to the left than him, but assumed that that was the kind of natural way to be, and feeling extremely alienated by that. And you know, I can totally see that there is a big constituency for that. And what UATX is doing is different to what Ron DeSantis is now signing off with New College Florida, which is a much more explicitly conservative, yeah. culture war type institution. UATX, I don't think, is that, even though lots of its funders are conservative. And it will therefore inevitably, because there's a big market, you know, there's a shortage of conservative institutions, attract conservative students. And you know, and I think it's also filled with people who've had serious academic jobs before. So I don't know. I talked to lots of people who sort of saw it as this kind of Trojan horse for indoctrinating people with conservative opinions. And I found that quite interesting because that's exactly the criticism the right makes of most colleges right now, which is that they're Trojan horses for indoctrinating young people with left-wing opinions. Mm. So I guess it proves that both sides really believe that colleges are an important vehicle for, you know, political education.
Helen Lewis, we're talking about her article in The Atlantic, How Joe Rogan Remade Austin. Take another break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for Radio West comes from our members. Sustain us at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the journalist Helen Lewis. Recently, she went to Joe Rogan's home base in Austin, Texas. She wanted to see the world that had coalesced around him and get a sense of the intellectual culture he's transmitting to the country. Do you think, in reporting this, you've, and other stories like it, that you've been able to identify what seems to be this kind of new emerging ideological kind of inclination. You mention those who, of course, have been drawn to Austin over the last few years and are drawn to people like Joe Rogan, as you put it in the piece, might be religious but are equally likely to be spiritual. They shoot guns but worry about seed oils. I liked that part. Are relaxed about gay people but often quite traditional about gender. Do psychedelics but worry about what caffeine is going to do to their, you know, cycle by drinking it in the morning. Like, it's a really interesting mix. And I wonder if you think it's just kind of a group of right-wing hippies or if it's an emerging group of people. Because you did talk to, as you said, those who weren't quite on the left but just really found the excesses of the left really tiresome and wanted someplace else to settle, it seems.
Yeah, and I do think that speaks to a lot of Americans. That they are neither, they watch a Donald Trump rally and they think that seems like an excessive level of enthusiasm for a political candidate. Yeah. But then they also don't really understand why you now have to capitalize the word black, or you now have to put your pronouns in your email signature, or now at work they're required to go to trainings about stuff, you know, when they don't feel that they've ever done anything wrong. Mm. And I think those are two, you know, very strong strands of American life of the last half decade or so. And I think lots of people find both of them slightly alienating. You know, and the big question for me was, you know, is anti-woke just conservative and in denial, mm-hmm. which is the charge that's often made. And it's a charge that's been made against me, right? So I'm British, so in American terms, you know, being kind of on the center left in Britain is being pretty left wing,
yeah.
in the US. But because of the subjects I've written about, and I've been quite skeptical of some of the kind of progressive catechisms of the last couple of years, people have just said, well, you are a conservative, you just haven't realized it yet, you're getting reactionary in your old age.
Yeah.
And one of the things I think that the last couple of years has made me appreciate is that we should cherish minority opinions. Sometimes they are right, and actually the whole of public conversation becomes better when people of good faith who are well informed but with different perspectives have to hash out their differences together. I mean, you know, it's why I think public radio is important. In the UK, we have the BBC, which is the state-funded broadcaster, which has a mandate that it has to represent the whole spectrum of opinion. So you will see a very right-wing politician and a very left-wing politician together on a political show. And people have to get both of those perspectives and, you know, maybe see what the points of agreement are between them and the points of disagreement, and maybe have, you know, even sense whether or not both of those people are arguing from the same set of agreed facts. And it's harder in the American media to get that. And so I can see why, you know, heterodoxy has appealed to a lot of people. And the question is whether or not that is an intellectual strand that is strong enough to survive, or if it just collapses into conspiracism, you know, or ends up, you know, people just end up eventually feeling that they have to pick a blue team or a red team.
Mm. I wanted to ask you said that you think the Joe Rogan coalition is fracturing. And this is how you kind of explain it in the piece. You say there's this kind of tension between, you know, the appeal of relitigating COVID and just endlessly living in 2020. And then that the tension with that against the real desire to escape polarization. So how do you understand the fracture that's playing out in that coalition?
Yeah, I mean, one of my interviewees I kind of quote as saying, you know, he thought that people were kind of in tune with him when they were criticizing some of what he saw as the excesses of the progressive movement. And then, you know, they turn around and say, you know, drag queens are corrupting our children into homosexuality, and this is a, you know, and then realizing, oh, we're not on the same side. Or, yeah, like there probably we have bigger differences between us than this one moment that united us.
Yeah.
And, you know, and that was true for me. I went up to the Texas Capitol, and, you know, I've written quite critically about some of the arguments made by the transgender movement that I feel are kind of danger of impinging upon women's rights. But I also felt very much not in tune with the conservative Christian activists there who were saying that, you know, gay people are grooming kids, and that they were kind of dismembering the soul and heart of the family. Mm. And I felt, well, you're not my people either. Mm. And I think that somewhere like Texas is an interesting example of that, because it must feel strange to live in Austin and have an extremely blue government and then travel, you know, only a couple of miles outside to find people who think very, very differently from you. And it explains why I think people in America often geographically sort themselves. They want to live in places where they feel that other people, you know, are in tune with them. When I was reporting my Ron DeSantis profile, I went to the Villages, which is the big retirement community outside Orlando. And I talked to a really wonderful woman in her 80s who said she was probably one of the only Bernie Sanders voters in the Villages, right? It's about 97% Trump supporters there. It hadn't been when she'd moved there 20 years ago, but actually it had become a place where if you were, you know, a right-leaning senior citizen, you knew that there were going to be other people there who were going to agree with you. And, you know, it starts off a kind of cascade where places end up going more and more and more in the direction that they started off on. And, you know, I've met people who have ended up moving because they have felt that their neighbours were just not on their wavelength. And that is a real dynamic that happens. And you know, the fact that we're in the middle of a presidential election that will come down in a country of 30 million people to maybe six states and a couple of 100,000 votes in each suggests that there is, you know, a kind of geographical sorting that's happened.
Well, you couldn't get an interview with Joe Rogan, of course, so you went to his show. Is he funny?
I laughed. I did laugh, which is the only real test of comedy.
Yeah.
Let me give him some notes as a much less successful person who sometimes does comedy shows. I think he's not the most talented stand-up that I've ever seen. He has a tendency to really shout his punchlines, and he doesn't have a lot of light and shade in his delivery. Mm. So you saw people on the bill that night who were more technically accomplished than him. I'm talking about Shane Gillis, who had a Netflix special that made me absolutely howl. And is a purveyor of a very good Donald Trump impression. Or Tony Hinchcliffe, who is an insult comic, which is not my type of comedy at all. It was too rough for me. But technically, it was really brilliant. And so those, I would say, were more accomplished stand-ups than Rogan. Where he is in his element is when he's got a guest that he's interested in and vibing with, and they have a low-key conversation. He can do that better than most people. When he's got somebody in front of him that he is genuinely interested by, and they're interested in him, and the tone is right, that can be really great. So I think he's not one of the world's best stand-ups. I think he's one of the world's best podcasters.
So one of the questions you didn't get to ask Joe Rogan was what his appeal might mean for the election next month. His fans, you describe as mostly male, predominantly white, a quarter are Latino, right-leaning, but not necessarily locked in for Donald Trump. So what influence do you think Joe Rogan or that coalition is going to have on the election? Any at all, as far as you can tell?
I think so. And I think one of the ways you can see that is in the trajectory of Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who started off this election cycle as a, you know, Democrat and was very puffed up by the right for that reason, right? They thought he was a great spoiler candidate, and then moved to being an independent who seemed to be drawing on the same pool of slightly kooky government suspicious voters that Donald Trump also appeals to, and has now, with the presumably promise of a job, ended up kind of going full on Trump, and is now, you know, campaigning to have himself taken off the ballots in states where it would hurt Trump, stay on in ballots in other states where it would help him. And I wonder how many of the people who thought of themselves as RFK voters, who thought of themselves as disillusioned with the whole system, will now stay at home, and how many of those people will transfer to Trump. You know, the polls, it's very hard because usually in polls about 3 points is the margin of error, so you can't, anything within that range is not seen as statistically significant. Mm. But obviously, within the context of American knife-edge elections, 3 points either way is often extremely decisive in individual states. So it's possible that the fact that some people in the you know, that Joe Rogan led them to RFK and RFK leads them to the Republicans might very well affect, you know, tens of thousands of votes. And everything is crucial in a U.S. election. And also, I think, You know, Rogan has sustained part of an intellectual sphere that has become incredibly important to the Republicans, not always to their benefit. You know, there's a huge amount of intellectual energy in that right-wing podcast space. I'm talking about the kind of the Daily Wires podcast, Tucker Carlson,
Shapiro.
You know, that is his empire. So he now employs, you know, Jordan Peterson and Matt Walsh and people like that. But my worry about that is that sometimes that is so well constructed and so hermetically sealed that I wonder if it allows people to become lazy in their thinking and actually slightly disconnected. And if you look at Donald Trump support, what's interesting about it is that there's a very high floor on it, but there also appears to be a kind of ceiling on it. I don't think anybody is expecting him to win the popular vote, for example, and he didn't either of the last two times that he ran. And there is a question about whether or not it's certainly true in Britain, you know, the sort of vitality of the right-wing podcast sphere kind of traps people into thinking that, well, no one thinks any differently to us apart from a handful of radical Marxists. Mm. It can become a kind of comfort blanket, I suppose, that actually, you know, we're the real Americans, we're the silent majority.
Helen Lewis, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Helen Lewis, she's a staff writer for The Atlantic. Her article, How Joe Rogan Remade Austin, appears in the October edition of the magazine. We'll put a link to it on our website. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We're also on YouTube at KUER 90.1. And you can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. Our intern is Stevie Shaughnessy, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.